And now, from beyond our dimension, this is the Jeff Mara Podcast. Here's Jeff.
My guest is R.L. Poole, member of American Mensa, author who is one of Graham Hancock's Author of the Month twice, and has also been on History Channel's The Unexplained with William Shatner. He has for many years studied the enigmatic Coral Castle and how a 100-pound man named Edward Leedskillman was able to create this castle out of massive coral stones all by himself. R.L., thank you for joining me and welcome.
Thank you, Jay. It's an honor to be on your show.
Well, we are excited to have you. And I think where it would be best to start is right from the beginning. And for those that don't know, what is the Coral Castle?
The Coral Castle is in Homestead, Florida. And it was built by a little small guy named Ed Leedskillman, who was an immigrant from Latvia. And it's the only modern megalithic structure ever built. And I believe this is personally the importance and the pricelessness of it, because most megalithic structures or all other megalithic structures that are built have been done in the ancient past, where there is very little chance of context or witness or recording. And Edward Leedskillman did this in the modern day. So I believe that this is the Rosetta Stone of megalithic structures, that if there are answers to be found in how this was done, that the answers would lie in Homestead, Florida.
Now, there are mysteries surrounding this structure. Can you tell us about those?
Oh, there's many. He built enigmatic shapes that people don't understand. And in fact, they still call them by the wrong name, or they misattribute what they are to represent. And it's no wonder, because Edward Leedskillman was indeed trying to fool people. There's no doubt about that. And some of the evidence that I have and that we'll talk about later will absolutely confirm to even the most skeptical person that Edward Leedskillman did not build this and then leave the and then die without leaving the secrets behind. He did. It's just that they haven't been recognized until about 10 years ago or so. And it was when I was lucky enough to stumble upon the trail of clues that I was able to recognize, interpret, and then discover the meanings behind them.
Do you think he wants the mystery to be solved?
Absolutely, I do. Absolutely, I do. And I think that he wanted it to be a world effort, even though I'm right now the only person who seems to have made much progress in this area. I have disseminated it to everyone that I can, because I want this to be a unified effort. I think this was meant to bring people together. It is my opinion that the Coral Castle is a megalithic classroom that is meant to teach the future generations his discoveries in science and in physics and in astronomy, and to cement his legacy. And I believe that he left all of these clues behind because he wanted to lay down almost like an intellectual gauntlet, a challenge that if you could find it, then you can have it. But he wasn't just going to give it to you, that you had to earn it like he earned it. He had to learn this somehow. And then he constructed almost like a game. And I think that's what attracted me to it, because the way he leaves clues and the way he does things, it's almost like a game of riddles. And I do believe sincerely that not only did he want it to be found, but he wanted it to be found by people who were smart enough to find what he left.
Do you know anything about Ed's educational background?
Oh, well, according to the folklore and everything that I've been able to find, Ed had a fourth grade education, but you have to keep in mind he was highly intelligent, because he came from Latvia to America and taught himself English, and he taught himself English so well that he was able to write excruciatingly efficient sentences, clues. He was able to use the English language as efficient or more efficiently than any native English speaker I know. And that right there to me denotes a high degree of intelligence and motivation. When you consider that he taught himself English, that he moved to an entirely different country, that he built this megalithic marble, some of the stone, one of them weighs 30 tons, that he did. This was a guy who, as I like to say, made the impossible look merely difficult by comparison. And I think that that has nothing to do with your academic experience. This has to do with whether a person really wants to learn or really wants to do something, they will educate themselves. And in that way, I would say Ed is probably the professor, not the student.
Has it been proven how he built the place?
No. And people have tried, believe me. There is an entire flock of researchers who are doing nothing except trying to prop up the prosaic explanation. They want to tell me and the rest of the world that a 100-pound man with pulleys, tripods, with 5-ton chain, you can lift 30 tons. That's not possible. That you cannot do that. You have a 10-ton chain hoist. You cannot do that. He's using telephone poles, wood, 5-ton chain, a 10-ton chain hoist, and he's lifting stones out of the ground that are rated many times more than the chains are rated for, many times more than the hoist is rated for, many times more than the structure itself is rated for, taller than the tripod stood, heavier than the equipment is rated for, larger than the diameter that the tripod stood. It's impossible by any standard. And all of the so-called experts who wish to push the prosaic theory have built nothing. They've not raised a single stone. They've not accomplished not a tenth of what Ed Lee Scullin did. So if their explanation is so easy, if it's so, you know, just rote and it's, you know, it's so easily explainable, well, then why haven't they done it? I'm confused. And so it seems to me, and especially based on some of the evidence that I've found, that there's a much larger game afoot here. And he has, it's almost like National Treasure. Do you know the movie?
Mm-hmm. It's a great movie.
It's a great movie. I love it. Well, I'm Ben Gates in this movie. And the Coral Castle is, you know, my mystery to solve. It's my national treasure. And it is, by the way, a national treasure, the Coral Castle Museum, because it is a storehouse and a warehouse of wisdom from millennia ago.
Would you say that this has become an obsession for you?
I don't know. I think we've moved from obsession into lifestyle. Like, this is all I do. This is all I think about. It's all I talk about. I have studied it relentlessly for 17 years now. And the first few years, I said to myself, I'm going to just read Ed's books. He wrote a couple of booklets, which are very popular in the Lee Scullin community. And they're these. It's Magnetic Current in Mineral, Vegetable, and Animal Life. And so here are the booklets that I carried with me for 4 straight years with absolutely no results whatsoever. And it's called Magnetic Current, Mineral, Vegetable, and Animal Life. And these two booklets were written by Edward Lee Scullin in the 40s. So I decided when I was going to research that I'm going to do away with all assumptions, that I'm going to start from ground zero, from scratch, with nothing. Not listen to anyone, only listen to Ed. And the best way to listen to him is to read his written works and to see what I could find. So I carried these books with me everywhere I went. I read them obsessively. And when I said they were excruciating, I really mean it's excruciating. It took me 2 weeks one time to work out the actual meaning of a single sentence that he wrote, because it's so dense. It's like pound cake. It's so dense. And so I carried them with me everywhere. And at the time, I wasn't a Coral Castle researcher. I was a blue collar worker. And 1 year, it was in 2010, I believe. I'm watching Iron Man on Christmas vacation, and I'm watching the part where he's in the cave and he's designing the Mark I armor. And a guy comes in and looks through his papers, and he doesn't discover it. And the reason he doesn't discover the plans is because each small part of the plan is kept on a different sheet of paper. And then when you overlap them and hold them up to the light, well, you see the full diagram, which is very clever. And the entire time I'm watching this movie, I keep looking down at the booklets. And I'm looking back at the screen, I'm looking at the booklets. And finally I say, wait, no, it couldn't be. And so what I did was I decided to overlap the covers. These are two transparencies that I made. And when you overlap the covers, what you get is a schematic. They fit like a key in a lock. And that's when I realized, oh, this isn't dead and gone. This has been hiding in front of us in plain sight the entire time. And I call this discovery the secret schematic. And on the cover of the book is something called a perpetual motion holder, which is a piece of equipment from Ed's design, because his entire world revolves around the study of one single thing, magnetism. It is his obsession, is magnetism. And he says that everything in the universe is caused by magnetism. And the perpetual motion holder that he designed was meant to capture and control magnetism. He even gives you instructions on how to build one, and I built one myself. And we can get into that later. The instructions are ridiculous at best, but I was able to accomplish it. But the amazing part to me was I made this discovery that when you overlap the covers, it creates the design he intended for you to see, but has been separated this entire time. And when that happened, I cannot describe to you the amount of exhilaration I felt having accomplished something. And then I had the thought that, wow, I'm the first person to see this since he hid it. I'm the first person to think of this. And I wish I could, I wish he had been alive so I could just let him know I found it. Somebody found it. You still live, you know, in the minds of people. And so when I discovered this, I realized, oh, he didn't hide it. I mean, he hid it, but he didn't take it with him. He left it for us. He left it for the perceptive and the persevering. He wanted people to study, search, and find what he left behind. He was the king of Easter eggs in that way. And for me, this discovery is what started it all. Was the perpetual motion holder. So here is one of Ed standing beside one of the enormous pieces on the east wall of the Coral Castle that they call the Great Obelisk. Here it is on the right side over here, if you can see that. That's where he's standing. And it's called the Great Obelisk, and it says it was made in 1923, moved in 1939, has his date of birth, his nation of birth, and his name. The entire place, this is actually where he lived. This is we call it the tower. And he was obsessed with the number 16. For some reason. And they said that he always called his unrequited love his sweet 16. But he was actually obsessed with the number. In fact, there are 16 steps going from the ground up to this tower where he lived. and he actually lived and worked on the grounds. It's in Homestead, Florida, which is 16 letters. He even died when he was 64, which is 16 plus 16 plus 16 plus 16. The number 16 surrounded him. It inundated him. And when I looked at the east wall of the Coral Castle, I found something that may have explained his obsession with that number. One of the things was the entrance sign to the Coral Castle, and I'll show you that. It was on my third visit to the Coral Castle that I noticed this, and it actually changed a lot of things for me, because I realized that he left it everywhere. Now, this is a photograph of the admission sign when you go into the Coral Castle. And it says admission, 10 cents, and it says drop below. And what I discovered is if you look underneath that little piece of pipe there where you would he would receive your little 10-cent donation, there's a word scrawled right here. And the picture is a little fuzzy because this is taken from a video presentation I did about the discovery. But the word that is written right here is SPICA, S-P-I-C-A, SPICA. Now, I had no idea what SPICA was at the time that I discovered this. I just simply noticed it. And then I looked it up and realized that SPICA is the brightest star in the constellation of Virgo. Even then, that didn't mean much to me. I was just like, okay, SPICA. And then somewhere along the way, someone told me the old timers' way of finding SPICA in the sky. And I was like, well, how do you do it? And he said, well, you have to drop below Polaris, follow the arc of Arcturus, and you will arrive at SPICA. And I said, hold on, wait, say that again? He said, yeah, you drop below Polaris. And I was like, oh, the admission sign, it says drop below.
That's great.
And if you notice that the sign is a five-pointed star, and it represents a star, and that star is SPICA. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Right. And I was like, oh, he is giving us the clues. So I said, okay, well, I still don't know what that means. And so I go in, and when you walk in, you see the east wall of the Coral Castle is the first thing you see, really, when you walk in. It's in the back. And you see these shapes. And people call this the Mars statue and Saturn and the large moon crescent, the small moon crescent. But it's not true. It's actually something else. And when I looked at the base of this statue right here that they call the Mars statue, I saw the word again. SPICA is scrawled into the coral. And then the M symbol for Virgo is actually on the base of that Mars statue. And I realized, oh, SPICA, these match. He wanted you to go from here to here. He wanted you to go from the entrance sign right to that back corner and see that it matches. And then once it matched, I thought, well, what does that mean? Okay, it's Virgo. All right, well, what does Virgo have to do with it? And so I started doing some comparisons between some of the shapes that I found at the Coral Castle and with the star constellations. And what I found was this. If you line these up, these three shapes actually comprise the constellation Virgo. And I thought, well, that's really amazing. He tells you SPICA, then he shows you SPICA, and then he says that he puts the constellation Virgo at the base, and then you see it matches the constellation of Virgo. But I was still kind of lost. It's amazing, but what does that mean? And so what I realized is I started going down the wall and realizing that, oh, it's not just that part of it. It's not just that constellation. but the entire east wall of the Coral Castle is a line of constellations. And it starts at Virgo and then Leo and goes down all the way through to the end to Taurus. And so then I began saying to myself, okay, well, what does this mean? Why would he do this? What's the point of building all of these structures to look like constellations? Ah, a star map. That's really what it is, right? It's a star map. Mm-hmm. And what do star maps do? Star maps don't tell us a where. They tell us a when. Stars mark time. And so I decided I was going to go through the Coral Castle and I was going to try to find all of the constellations and celestial alignments that I possibly could to try to come up with a signature, a fingerprint, if you will, that I could use to then match against every celestial event that's ever happened, basically in time. I would have to go back and try to track it. And what I did was I found that there were 16 celestial alignments carved into and in front of the east wall of the Coral Castle. And they go, there's Spica, there's Saturn, there's Virgo, there's Leo, there's Cancer, there's M44, the Beehive Galaxy, M104, the Sombrero Galaxy, Gemini, Taurus. And then, of course, the 16th one would be us, the Earth. And so I realized if I was going to find anything out, I would have to go and try to retrace this pattern of celestial alignments because it's unique. And there, you only need a 14-point match for a fingerprint. This is 16, which is even more. So I used my Google Star Map app, and it has this cool feature on it where you can go back through time. You can put a date in, and it will show you what the stars and the planets were aligned like on that day. So I just went through every day was it 1951 when he passed away? And I just started going back and back and back every day, every day, every day. And I finally found the exact match. Not close, not off by one, the exact match. And the exact match happens on September 10th, 1923. And it was the year he built the Coral Castle, as I showed you on the date on the stone that he wrote. He built it in 1923, and that wall, the entire wall of the Coral Castle, is a star map, and the star map tells a date and time of September 10th, 1923, at 6:08 p.m.
Was that the date that he began or completed?
Ah, that's a very good question, and I have to say it's one that I'm not sure that I know the answer to, but here's what I can tell you. I think that the alignment was the way he was able to build the Coral Castle. I would say he was probably building it on that day. And the reason I say that is because he was very interested in magnetism, right? And in his written works, he says, in this little sentence that really changed everything, says, the Earth itself is a great big magnet. That's not really disputable information, is it? I mean, it is a magnet. We have a north and a south pole. We rotate with a spin. We generate electricity. We're a magnet. And then I said, oh, wait. Well, if we're a magnet, then if you extrapolate that, you can see that all celestial bodies are, in one form or another, a giant sphere magnet. And then he goes on to tell you in his written works what you can do with sphere magnets. And I thought to myself, what if he is using these alignments as a way to amplify some effect that he's performing, right? Because he has this generator wheel that he built. He has this perpetual motion holder that he made. He hid part of the schematic. So there's a hardware component where he is creating something, a field, I believe, of some type. But what if it only works during certain times? So on September 10th, 1923 is actually an extremely rare celestial alignment. It has Venus, the Sun, the Moon, and the Earth, all in a straight line. This is called a syzygy, when three or more celestial objects are, and their equators are aligned. It's called a syzygy. And in this case, there's four, with Venus in occultation behind the Sun. So again, mysteriouser and mysteriouser. Yeah. So again, I'm like, I don't know necessarily what that means. And then I'm watching another video on magnetism, trying to understand what Ed's telling us. And I see this demonstration of a Gauss rifle. Do you know what a Gauss rifle is?
I don't.
A Gauss rifle is a type of weapon that fires a projectile without the use of propellant. It simply uses rows of magnets in a straight line that when you roll it, it propels it at amazing speed. And I was looking at the trigger mechanism of a Gauss rifle, and it immediately, I understood. If you look at the most simplistic version of the trigger mechanism of a Gauss rifle, you'll see a ball bearing, a large neodymium magnet, and then a ball bearing and a ball bearing, all separated from each other. And as soon as I saw that, all I could see in my head was a planet, a sun, a planet, and a planet. A ball bearing, a giant neodymium magnet, a ball bearing, and a ball bearing in a straight line. They're exactly the same. And then now if you understand that he says that these celestial objects are giant sphere magnets, and then you realize how the trigger mechanism of a Gauss rifle works, where you go, oh, it's the same thing. Is there some giant push that happens during this, where he could amplify this magnetic effect and take advantage of it? And so I decided to look up where he was on this day. And on the day where you have Venus, the Sun, the Moon, and the Earth, he's actually on the opposite side, on the end of that transaction. And I believe that this was purposeful, that he was in that place at that time, because he knew that this alignment was going to happen. And when it happened, if he was prepared and had done things properly, that he'd be able to amplify whatever this effect was and then use that to lift stone that otherwise would not able to be lifted, or carve stone, quarry it in a way that we haven't seen in the modern era. And what I believe he's doing is he is exploiting a loophole that he has found in physics that allowed him to create this effect.
How long would this celestial alignment last? Because I would think it would take him more than a day to construct this.
And that's a very good point. Some of these, they only stay in exact alignment for just a few minutes. However, this effect, I believe, was being amplified. So when you first have the effect going for you, well, it'll be easy to amplify. And then as it moves out of phase, you would have to amplify it more and more and more to buy yourself time, I believe, in order to accomplish some of these things. But I believe that he had a few hours at a time to work. And people said that he worked on the Coral Castle for years to get it built. And I don't believe it was because it was so laborious. I believe he was simply waiting for the next cycle. And they tend to have to do with eclipses, I've noticed. And we have on average about four eclipses a year. So if he had the right eclipse, if he had the right celestial alignment, if there was a helpful syzygy, then he would have to wait for that cycle, but do all his prep work ahead of time. So that way, when it does happen, he's ready. And so I believe he had maybe a few hours at a time, but when you make the work that easy, I bet you'd be amazed what you could get done in a few hours.
Where did he quarry the blocks from?
Right there, right where he was.
Oh.
In fact, the quarry is there at the Coral Castle. It's one of the parts of the museum. You can go and visit it. In fact, they have the snack bar. You can buy drinks and some food over there. And you sit under the shade of the umbrellas and you look at this giant quarry where these pieces of stone look like they were cake cut out of a sheet pan. There is no rough work. This is all clean cuts. You can see the dividing lines. You can see where he cut underneath the stone, lifted them out. And this actually led me to kind of another clue that perhaps he was doing something that we didn't quite understand. And that is these are the wedge marks that are in the walls of the blocks that compose the walls of the Coral Castle. And as you can see, they're very distinct. And they actually show to me what I measured as depressions in the coral, as though the coral were being compressed and displaced, which is curious because that isn't how coral behaves when it is subjected to pressure. I measured them, and you can see, and what I did was I actually measured these against the tools that he had in his workshop, and he used springs, leaf springs, straightened out leaf springs, which are made of soft steel. And he's driving 3 feet of soft steel in a wide, thin wedge shape, 2-3 feet down into solid bedrock coral by hand. You're telling me that he's doing this by hand, and he's doing it with brute strength, which he didn't have. He weighed 100 pounds soaking wet with a brick in each hand. So there's no way he's physically driving these in. And then, so when I looked at these wedge marks, what I realized is that there is compression here. In fact, you can even see where the part where the slats went, these wedges, you can see how it becomes much finer grained. You can see how it compresses. And it gave me the impression that this was soft, almost like clay when he was doing this. This doesn't look like a person who was hand driving these wedges into the ground. It looked like the marks that would be left when you put a yard sale sign in your front yard, that it would just softly go through without much resistance. And that's what I saw here. And I believe that the effect that he was creating not only made the stones lighter, but also made them softer. And I believe that this carries over into other works like Markawase and Ollantay Tambo, Pumapunku, places like this in other parts of the world where we see these same kind of marks, impressions. It looks like the stone was soft at some point. And I believe it has to do with the secret that Ed had discovered and was exploiting to build his megalithic marble.
Is it possible that he had help from an ET?
Yeah. So I got to tell you, you sound like George Norrie. He said the same thing to me. And like George, I have to agree that I believe he was tipped off to something, that he wasn't born with this knowledge. I believe the way that the ancients knew, and I think this is where your question comes from, is because this was done thousands of years ago. If this was the first time this had been done, you could go, oh, well, who knows? But when we know that these were done a millennia ago by primitive cultures, and that they had visitations, that there were ancient aliens, they were the gods of our past. They were the ones who handed down some of this knowledge. And I believe that it's their equivalent of Boy Scout technology. I think that this is not a big deal to them. They go, oh, you just do this and this, and then this will happen. See? But to us, it's a revelation. We don't understand because we see things completely wrong. So when we see it, it's a surprise. But I believe to them, it's the equivalent of Boy Scout technology. It's no big deal. And I believe that it's possible that he had this information shared with him because of some of my own experiences, which I know that isn't what this is about, but I have had abduction experiences and things like that. And I know that they communicate with you, and I know that they can do that through kind of like a download. It's like you just get a download of information. And I think that it's possible that this secret was shared with him to revive it, to bring it back from the past.
Well, with all your studies of the Coral Castle, is there any evidence that points in that direction?
There isn't anything that I can definitively point to, unfortunately, and say, aha, there it is, the smoking gun. But I have to tell you, he certainly didn't look at things the way people normally do. One of those things was astronomy itself. He reprises scientists many times in his written works for arriving at their conclusions through indirect and ultra indirect methods. He had a form of logic that even I find frightening in its clarity. And I'm a person who prides myself on my logic, but he taught me how much I didn't know. And one of those things has to do with very simple astronomy. And while this may seem controversial for a moment, bear with me. He built things to teach us. He says in his written work, he said, I built a rock telescope and a rock sundial, and they defooled me. He said, scientists should come down to Rockgate Park, which is what the Coral Castle was called when he was alive. He called it Rockgate Park. And he said, they should look at the drawing on the red, or they should look at the Polaris telescope, the rock sundial, and the drawing on the red door, and see what they have to tell us about science. So far, I seem to be the only person who's done that and made any sense of it. But what it says is so strange. And I'll give you a little brief. This is the Polaris telescope. It's 28 tons, stands about 26 feet tall. It has a circle and a crosshair in it. And it also has a base down here on the ground, and you have to look through it like an aperture. And when you look up through it at that angle, and you do it on any clear night, you will see Polaris in one of the four quadrants of this Polaris telescope. However, it's not really a telescope. You see, he named it that, but that isn't what it is. Because it doesn't bring the star in closer to you. It doesn't magnify anything. What it does is it simply marks the position of a star. Well, we have something that does that. It's called a sextant. And a sextant marks the position of a star in the sky. But he did something even more amazing than that, because Polaris is not exactly north. Polaris is our closest pole star, but it's off by about 2 degrees of true north. So in order to be able to see Polaris moving around the quadrants, what he would have had to do is mark exact true north. There was no app for that back then. He built a stone that was 28 tons, carved a hole in it, set two wires in it, and it's exactly perfectly true north. He went to a lot of trouble to do this, and there's a reason why. And the way he puts them together, he says the Polaris telescope, the rock sundial, and the drawing on the red door. Now, the Polaris telescope, since he marked true north, what you can do is if you track Polaris throughout the seasons, it comes to a full circle. That circle is our orbit. See, Polaris in this situation, we see it move, but it's not moving. We are, right? That's why the star moves. It's not because the star is moving, but because we are as we go around the sun. Well, so what this is the topographic view of our actual orbit. If you were looking at the solar system from the top down and you were looking at the Earth, this is the shape it would make. So he has showed the top view of our orbit, the topographical view. But why, right? And then we go to the sundial. And again, the sundial, it doesn't make any sense. It's an analematic sundial, which is extremely difficult to make accurately. And it people say that it's accurate and shows the correct time, but I've been there four times now, and every time I'm there, I check my watch against it. And I'm like, it's off by a bit, by a few minutes, usually when I go. It's not exact. But then I realized, well, maybe it's not meant to capture the time as we look at it. We look at our time. But what this captures is sidereal time, which is the actual time, sun time. Our day, 24 hours, is not quite exactly a day. And in sidereal time, a day is 23 hours, 56 minutes, 14 seconds, something like that. It's slightly less, which is why we have to make corrections to our calendar and daylight savings times and things like that. Well, so I realized, okay, so this is meant to capture sidereal time or star time. So what would be the point of that? And then I became fascinated with the sundial and the gnomon because it was such a mystery. So I said, okay, so if the Polaris telescope is showing us the topographical view, well, then that means that this must be producing the orthographic view or the side view that we would need to have a complete picture of what our orbit around the sun would be. So we have the topographic view, and then we would have the orthographic view. We would see the shape of our orbit, and then we would see the angle of our orbit. And so that led me to the Red Door. And this is the Red Door. It's still there at the Coral Castle, although I must say it's in poorer condition because it's rusting and it's Florida. So I took this picture, and if you look at it, it shows, it says the sun in the middle, and then it has the Earth down here, and it says 21, and then there's another representation of the Earth up there. And if you notice, it doesn't seem to align with any of the school books that you and I were taught from. It seems to be something different about it, and I'm pretty sure it is the angle at which he is showing the Earth's orbit. So down here it says Earth 21, and then up here it has it, and I believe that the 21 represents 621, the summer solstice, okay, the point at which we are in summer, and then up here would be the winter solstice, right? And in the middle, there's the sun. And then in the middle, what most people tend to not notice is in the middle there, I believe that's the equinox that he is representing. So all three phases on one side. And so you look at this and you say, why is he showing this angle like this? Why does he believe that the Earth is moving at an angle to the sun? And it was because he measured it. And I believe he's right. And the reason I believe he's right is because recently there was a very cool image that came out, and it had to do with a guy who took a pinhole photograph, which is a very old way of doing photography. And he took a pinhole photograph of the sun and the sky over the period of a year, an entire year. And I saw that picture, and it reminded me of something. And so when you take the two and you overlay them, what you get is this. His pinhole photograph and Ed's door exactly match. And so what I believe that Ed Leiskanen is trying to show people is that the Earth doesn't go around the sun the way we think it does. And he even says in his written works, we slide axis way around the sun. Now, what would be the odds of a person from 75 years ago drawing something random on a door, and then 75, 80 years later, a guy takes an exact pinhole photograph of the way that the sun moves in the sky over the period of a year, and then you put them together and they exactly match. They exactly match. The odds are zero.
Yeah, it's amazing. If you go back to the other picture of the door, the center almost looks like there's a nine Or maybe that's just the way the photograph looks. That and I, maybe it's just the photograph. And I noticed that there are 16 points on the star.
That's a very good catch. That's right. There are 16 points on the star. That's very interesting. I don't see what, I do kind of see what you're saying.
Right.
There's like a line right here. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're referring to right here?
Yeah, and I couldn't tell.
Yeah. Well, you know, it could be.
On the Polaris structure that you showed us earlier, it had the date 1940. Is there any correct significance with that?
I do, but I don't believe it's celestial. Mm-hmm. So this is the mystery that actually led me to writing The Key of Liedskalnen. So when Ed passed away, he had, of course, left behind some personal effects. He died of a kidney infection, a raging kidney infection, and it had entered his bloodstream. And he had left a note that said, going to the hospital, and then he never returned. He died in the hospital. Now, I've done a lot of digging about this time, because this is when other folks were able to peer into his life and find things out that we wouldn't ordinarily know. And I actually was able to contact the Mays family, which were the ones, his attorney, which was the only person he really had in his life, was named Mays. He was actually the mayor of Coral Gables, and he was a good man, from what I understand. I actually talked to his daughter, and she's 90 now, I believe. But she was really excited to talk to me, and I wanted to know. They said that they had went down and they had claimed some of Ed's personal effects and went through them, and they found some things that were quite strange. One of the things they found was a shoebox full of letters. And in the shoebox full of letters, they were written to Doris Duke. If you don't know who she is, it's no surprise. She was the heiress to the Duke tobacco fortune, and she was the richest girl in the world during the time that Ed was alive. Well, it seems that they found this shoebox full of letters that he had written to her. And I found that extremely odd. Why would you have a box full of letters that you'd never sent? And why are you writing Doris Duke when she's the richest girl in the world and you're the poorest man in the world? Why are you writing her? And also, why are you not sending the letters? And then I realized, oh, you know, this is what you do when you're speaking in code. When you talk, when you write something encoded, you write a copy for yourself so you can keep a chronological track of the conversation. And I asked her, Miss Hicks, I said, what were the contents of the letters? She said, oh, they were very romantic, and they made us blush. They were very romantic. And I was like, yeah, that didn't strike me as a super romantic guy, a hermit who lives alone all his life, never dates, never marries, never kissed a girl, but he's so romantic. It just struck me odd. And so I started looking into Doris Duke, and what I found was there are some big similarities in the life of Doris Duke and Ed Liedskalnen. The year that Ed enters New York, Doris Duke was born in New York. Same year, same time, same place. That's odd. She, if 1938 was her sweet 16 birthday, that's the year he moved the Coral Castle to its present location in Homestead. 1940, she had a miscarriage and lost her child. And that's the date that's carved on the Polaris telescope. I believe that these dates and these letters signify a connection between Doris Duke and Ed Liedskalnen that is undeniable. And then I realized, oh, well, she was a correspondent. She was a war correspondent during World War II. And it's also been proven that she was a spy for the SAS. She was beautiful, rich, and had access to everyone and everything. So she'd be the perfect spy, right? So then I realized, oh, well, they speak in code. They had the Enigma code was very famously broken during World War II. And so I started applying that bent to their correspondence, which I'm not able to get a hold of. Nobody knows where the letters are now. But there was a story, because I said, how is he writing to her? And she said, well, he believed that she was talking to him through a comic strip called Doris. And I was like, Doris. So I looked it up. It's actually not called Doris. It's called The Dailies. But the main character was named Doris. And the character Doris just happens to look exactly like Doris Duke. Okay. And she said that he believed that she was communicating with him through this comic strip. And I thought, well, why would he believe that? Well, where were the dailies published? They were published in something called Harper's Bazaar. Right? Guess who Doris Duke wrote these articles for that were published during World War II as a war correspondent? Go ahead, take a guess. Harper's Bazaar.
Okay. I don't.
So how in the world would all of these things be a coincidence, right? So I decided I was going to try to find the key, because you can have Enigma code, but if you don't have the exact key, you're just wasting your time. You will get nothing but gibberish. So I was like, well, he's left everything else. He should leave this. And he did. And it was these numbers he carved inside the castle tower. 7129610-5195. Now, those are numbers from a form, from his immigration form, but I thought it means more than that. What if he used them as the key to the encryption? Numbers that he would never forget, numbers that he had carved in a wall, numbers that nobody else would even understand or what the purpose of. So one night I'm sitting there in my chair and I'm looking at this with a pencil, and I'm just like, wow, this doesn't say anything. I tried to do it phonetically, you know, like each letter represents something in the English alphabet. And it came out Gabby Fiehi. And I was like, well, that doesn't mean anything. And then all of a sudden it occurred to me, oh, it doesn't mean anything in English. So I started researching it. And what I learned was that Gabby Fiehi is Prussian. It's not just Prussian, it's old Prussian. It's old Prussian that isn't even spoken anymore. I had to send about 47 different emails to this linguistics expert who specialized in old Prussian. And he said, I can tell you this does say a phrase, but it may not make sense to you. And I was like, okay, what does it say? And he says, it says gifted fairies in old Prussian. And I was like, oh, the gifted fairies. The fairies bestowed a gift on me. I get it. That if you found this, the gifted fairies had paid you a visit, and now you have the code. So what I did was I realized, oh, these numbers are a book code. And you use the letters just like you got this message. And just like this message, it won't be in English. So I started going through a book in every home, one of the other books that he wrote, which everyone has claimed has been encoded. And it is. Enigma encoded. And so I had to go through the book and use the book code he gives you to get the settings for the Enigma machine, and then ran it through the Enigma machine, and then it actually started spitting out answers, scary answers. And it also, I applied this to one of the comic strips of the dailies, because I was like, well, if they're speaking in code, maybe he used the same Enigma code. He had it still worked. And it came out to a message that said, measure the rate of your growth or slow down in light of future generations. Like, it's an actual message that passes the chi-square, fails the null hypothesis. It absolutely works. It's provable. It's repeatable. It works. And these monuments, some of them, I believe that his sweet 16 was Doris Duke. I believe that they knew each other, they communicated to each other, and somehow they were collaborating on this. I believe that it's possible she was even financing him to find the land, to buy the meager equipment that he used and things like that, to allow him to build this. because she was very interested in the preservation of art, of science. She was obsessed with those kinds of things and poured tons of her own money into it and her own effort. And I believe that Ed approached her maybe with this idea, and she was absolutely in love with it. And I believe he dedicated some of these monuments to her. I'm sorry, that's a really long story I had to tell, but I believe that some of these monuments were actually dedicated to Doris Duke. And I believe that this one in particular, the Polaris telescope, was dedicated to her loss in 1940 of her only child she would ever try to have. And it is the Eternal and North Star, which I think is just beautiful.
If we step back from all of this and try to take a big picture, what is the point of the whole thing, do you think? Is it to teach humanity something?
I believe it is to reteach humanity something. I think you said it fine. You know, it's to reteach that we are discovering things we already knew, but thousands of years ago, things that were taught to us maybe by the sky gods, by the sky teachers, by aliens, extraterrestrials who came here, interacted with man, and they shared some of these little tidbits of knowledge with us that we kept and held on to as long as we could. But because of the way man does things, we compartmentalize things, we specialize things, we capture them, and we want to hold on to them. Sometimes your grasp can be so tight that you cannot hold on to the thing you wish to hold on to. And I believe that's the way it was with this information. I believe that's how it was with the Egyptians, because they had priests who had all these secrets carved into these temples, but only the priest could really understand and explain to you what it's saying. And then that priest would have his acolytes who would follow in their footsteps and learn that wisdom and take over their spot in this passing down of information. Well, that culture doesn't exist anymore. And when that culture no longer existed, then that information was no longer accessible. If you look at, you know, all of the ancient megalithic structures of the past, those cultures are no longer the way they were. The Mayans, the Egyptians, they're not the same. And this information got lost. I believe it's still there. And I think that if we figured this out again today, that we could go back to those ancient megalithic structures and they would make a lot more sense to us. We would know why there's a shaft pointing out of the pyramid to the star and one pointing out to this star. We would know why they were obsessed with astronomy in the first place. I mean, you have the Mayans who were obsessed with the stars. Why would that help them in any way? Except you notice they built megalithic structures, you see, and there is this link between astronomy and megalithic structures that cannot be denied. And I believe that part of that is understanding our celestial mechanics correctly. And I believe that's why Ed went to so much trouble to build these sextants and the sundial and the drawing on the red door and all these things to try to not tell us, but to allow us to discover it for ourselves, because that is how you convince people, as they discover it for themselves. If you tell someone something, they may or may not believe you, but if you show it to them, if they can show it to themselves, then there is no dispute about what the truth is. And I believe that his entire world was built around us rediscovering the truth that we lost so many thousands of years ago.
He shows Spica twice. Do you think it's possible, if this was intervention from ETs, that they would be from the solar system with Spica?
Oh, I don't know. I never considered that. That's a good question.
If there is a solar system or planets revolving it, you know?
Yeah, I don't know that either, to be honest with you. I think that he had to have an anchor point for the constellation to be recognized. So I don't think it's a coincidence that the star he tells you about is the first one that you encounter on the wall. I think it was done purposely for the order of it, that you'd say, oh, Spica, and then that's Spica, and then that would lead you to all the rest of it. I believe it was meant to unfold that way, but I'm not necessarily disagreeing with you. That could be true.
Also, what makes me curious is that he doesn't show all of the constellations, right? Like of the zodiac. Why does he choose just those specific ones?
Oh, great question. The reason is because he's showing them in their position with the celestial and ecliptic equators, how they appear on those lines. So this is what also made it very difficult to recognize, is because we have the ecliptic equator and we have the celestial equator. And this line on the wall where they all rest actually represents the celestial equator. And all of these things are setting on that line as they would appear when you go around. And so some of them are above and some of them are below. And in fact, Taurus is actually inverted in the actual sky. If you look at it, it's actually upside down. But the only way for him to be able to show it is to flip it right side up. But he still uses the celestial equator as the line upon which it rests. So it looks different than it will if you encountered it in the sky, because he's actually having to draw the line of the equators so that way you can mark the spots that he's showing you.
I guess what I'm wondering is, why didn't he continue this wall and include all of them?
Ah, well, that's because he's timing it. It's about a time, right? And he included 16 different celestial
maybe that's bodies because of the word number 16.
I believe number 16, and also 16 is more than enough. A 14-point match is enough to convict someone with a fingerprint. 16 is irrefutable.
Is there any other significance with the number 16?
There could be so many. And that's the issue. You know, there's, I believe, here's an interesting one that's kind of out of left field, but the tower that I showed you earlier, where Ed actually stayed at the Coral Castle, remember I told you that it has 16 stairs leading up to it. In tarot, the number of the tower in tarot is 16. I find that very compelling. Because this tells me that there's a hint that Ed may have known some occult knowledge. I don't think it's a coincidence that there's 16 stairs going up that tower and that the number of the tower is 16 in tarot. I don't think that's a coincidence. Much like his other symbols that he liked to use. He liked to use 5 and 6-pointed stars to denote some of the things in the Coral Castle. If you, I don't know if you can see in this picture, but in this picture of Ed, there is a 6-pointed star right here where the constellation of Cancer is represented on the constellation wall. Two confirmations. One, he's standing underneath the constellation represented as Cancer, and he was also, his birth sign was Cancer. And then above that is a 6-pointed star that's embedded in the wall beneath Cancer. And if you look at the back of a dollar bill, the Great Seal of the United States, you'll notice that on one side there will be a star, a 6-pointed star that is composed of 5-pointed stars. And it symbolizes out of many, one. Yes, out of many stars, one giant 6-pointed star. Well, in Ed's world, it works very much the same way. You'll notice on the entrance sign, it was a 5-pointed star, which represented a single star called Spica. Well, in this case, the 6-pointed star represents M44, or the Beehive Galaxy. Many 5-pointed stars equal one 6-pointed star. Same code. And again, this is Freemasonry symbolism that we're talking about. So we're talking about Freemasonry symbolism. We're talking about tarot symbolism. It's all over the place. So it's really hard to try to pin one thing down and say, this is why he was doing this, or this is what he was doing. What I believe is he was using all of these things on Melange. to encapsulate these secrets in a way that was just using modern culture as a context. You see, because I feel like that's the part that's been lost, is I can go look at the pyramids and I can observe them and I can make observations, but what I can't do is I can't read ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics. And even if I could, I don't understand the context in which they are writing. The context of 2000 years ago and the context of today are completely different. They are alien to each other, for lack of a better term. But Eds was built in the 20th century. He spoke and wrote in English. He was using things from our modern world, symbolism, astronomy, celestial mechanics. He was using all the things from our modern world to encode the secrets. So this is what made me feel like this is the closest chance we will ever have to understand the mysteries of our past, is if we study the most modern megalithic structure made, the Coral Castle.
Why do you think he kept all this a secret?
I believe it was because he wouldn't be believed. That most people wouldn't understand and most people wouldn't believe it. He could have told everyone, but people are unscientifically skeptical. Many people in these areas, I feel like, maybe weren't educated enough to understand what he's trying to teach. Also, I believe this is a powerful secret. I don't think that he wanted this to be in just anyone's hands, because he knew how powerful the secret was, that he was like, it's so good, I can't keep it to myself, but I have to hide it, almost as a way of security, that the person who's smart enough to find this will be smart enough to know what to do with it. And I would say that's probably not that many people. So he's minimizing the risk of disaster from this secret, but also leaving it to be found at the same time. I think it was the best he could do as far as security, while being fair.
I feel like this is still unsolved. And in your opinion, what is left for us to figure out?
In my opinion, what's left to figure out is the technical component. Okay, because we don't know exactly what his setup was. We see some mysterious things. For instance, we see this tripod, we see these chains, we see this black box that's on top. And this is often the subject of quite a bit of debate, this black box that is on top of the tripod that he used. And it was always on top of the tripod that he used when he was moving the stones. Now, people have formulated many opinions about this and many theories. I believe that what was in there was the perpetual motion holder with the secret schematic added to it once you discover it. And if I actually did the math from the dimensions of the box, took the dimensions of other things, and then ran the dimensions of the box, and they match almost exactly the exact dimensions of the perpetual motion holder. So I believe that that is what was up in the box. However, what we don't have is the mechanical aspect of this. I believe I have figured out the celestial mechanics involved, that there has to be certain alignments, but we have to start reinterpreting what we know about magnetism, what we think we know about gravity, what we think we know about all these different sciences. We have to readjust all of our thinking on these. We have to change the dial on each one until we get that right answer. And if we're going to stay stuck in the same rote, memorized type of science, then we're never going to progress. And what he's done is he's really shaken it up. We need to re-examine our physics. We need to re-examine our astronomy. And we need to discover his mechanical setup, that how was he using the generator wheel, the perpetual motion order? How was he using all these tools together? Because he obviously was. And it certainly wasn't to lift the stone out of the ground the prosaic way. So what was that real purpose? And you can look at that and say, oh, you know, we have the perpetual motion holder up here. Now that we add the secret schematic, it goes from being magnetic to being electrical. Well, now that we know that it goes from magnetic to electrical with the secret schematic, now those chains don't look like chains to me. They look like wires. They look like conductors. And now we have to stay exact. You see what I mean? That we have to start looking at these things for what they're not. there it's an illusion. What he's doing is he's creating an illusion. Like, oh, I have this tripod and I have these chains and this chain hoist and I use this to lift stone, when really what he may be doing is using it to run this giant shock of current down these conductors into the stone during this celestial alignment, shocking the magnetism out of it and causing it to just simply float in the air for a little while. We have to reimagine everything he's shown us, because I have proven again and again that what he shows us is not what he wants us to see. We must pierce the veil.
RL, I think your information is amazing, and it appears that you have not only one, but maybe two books about it. So if they want to find more, they can check into those, right?
Absolutely. You want to go on Amazon and just type in R.L. Poole or the Lee Skolnik Codex or the Key of Lee Skolnik, and I should come right up. I'm happy to say the Lee Skolnik Codex was the number one bestseller in the physics of gravity on Amazon for a brief while, and it's 59 pages that will shake up your world.
Do you have anything else that you're working on that you want us to know about?
Yes, thank you for asking. I'm actually working on my third book right now, and it's not about the Coral Castle. This book is personal to me, and it is about my abduction experiences and contact experiences over the past 40 years. And the name of the book will be Beneath the Haunted Sky, Chronicles of an Alien Abductee. And there I'll be sharing my own personal experiences, my own photographic evidence and personal testimony, showing the chronology of these experiences and how they have changed me and how they might change the minds of others too.
Well, it's a good thing for me, because now I have another reason to bring you back.
You don't need a reason. You can ask me anytime and I would love to be here.
Well, thank you for that. RL, after watching this podcast, people may have questions. Are you open to them? And if so, how can they reach you?
I'm very open to questions, because that's the only way we ever get answers, right? And if people have questions for me about the Coral Castle, about my experiences, feel free to contact me at talkingtoleedskolnik@gmail.com. It's all one word, and maybe I'll send you, or you can share the link to my email if you'd like. Also, I have a channel called Talking to Lee Skolnik by the same name. And I also have a little secret channel called Coral Castle TV, which everyone is welcome. And I have a Patreon under the name Coral Castle TV as well, if people would like to support.
RL, before we finish up, can you give us one last positive message?
Yes. The world is full of mystery. It is full of wonder. And it's only when we stop looking that we forget that. Places like the Coral Castle. Simply look up every once in a while. You'd be surprised at what you might see. But at the end of the day, no matter what you see, always keep looking up.
RL, thank you for your message, and thank you for being my guest.
It was an honor.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for watching the Jeff Mara podcast. I really appreciate you. Another way to show support is through YouTube memberships. And if you do, there are loyalty badges and other perks depending on your level of membership. All you need to do is click the join button underneath the video to find out more. Thank you for your support.